Please silence all electronic devices.
All of a sudden, that race that we didn't anticipate of being really one of the really interesting ones, all of a sudden is one of the most interesting ones.
But as a practical matter, when it comes to what's been going on in state government and state politics, it's clear that we've had some transformation in the parties, particularly, I would say, the Republican Party, the party that nominated John McCain for president.
Any further discussion or debate?
For the final time in 2019, welcome to the WUNC Politics Podcast. A treat to have you along. My name is Jeff Tiberi, and it is time for a final weekly review of North Carolina politics, but also a look back at what happened this year and also this decade. Here for the conversation are Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation.
Hello, hey, my there. Friends.
Before we get to the retrospective stuff, let us begin with a couple of 2020 announcements that came Thursday from two prominent North Carolina politicians. Republican Congressman Mark Meadows announced that he will not seek re-election to the U.S. House in 2020. In his unexpected decision, Meadows hinted at a role with the Trump administration. Former Governor Pat McCrory said he will seriously consider running for what is expected to be an open U.S. Senate seat in 2022, which is a bigger deal, and why?
I think Meadows is a bigger deal because McCrory, I think, is yesterday's news. I think he may attempt to revive his career, but he's a two-time loser in statewide races. I still think it would be a long shot for him to advance, although he does have good name recognition. He polls okay with Republicans. Mark Meadows is a national figure, even really a bigger figure nationally than he is in North Carolina. And the idea of him playing some sort of a prominent role in the Trump administration is obviously an intriguing one. He was rumored before to be a potential chief of staff for Trump at one point. He, of course, the challenge when you take on a role in the Trump administration is you don't know how long it will last, not only because of the fact that the president has been impeached, but because of the fact that the president is mercurial and fires people left and right all the time. So, but I think that's a bigger story, perhaps, and the fact that he seemed to be in a safe position and now is giving it up.
Well, I think, you know, for the immediate impact, it absolutely is Mark Meadows. Again, you know, Pat McCrory has been considering, we've been hearing for months, would he consider running for governor again, different things. But the immediate impact is Mark Meadows resigning. And I think that's significant for a couple reasons. One is Mark Meadows had really been elevated to positions of leadership within the Republican caucus in Congress, which elevates the voice, if you will, of North Carolina, the representation within the North Carolina
right.
delegation.
And the Freedom Caucus, which,
and
which
the Freedom
he
Caucus,
co-founded.
Right. And then, you know, close alliance with the president, it just aligns North Carolina sort of at a higher tier in the nation. And so I think Mark Meadows stepping aside, the thing that I think also really brings to mind and why it may be even more significant, kind of what we're waiting for is the next step with this. He's not resigning to ride off into the sunset and do nothing. He's resigning for something, and he's kind of hinted that that might be an appointment in the Trump administration or something else. And I think this everything indicated as this decision became as we became aware mm-hmm. of it, would indicate that this was a pretty hasty decision on his part. And so something is going on, and what that is, and that could have even bigger implications.
So I will push back on that briefly, only to note that this more – I will push back briefly on that only to note that on Thursday morning we fairly quickly heard a name out of Haywood County, that name being – Linda Bennett, and she is the vice chair of the GOP operation up there. She had a website ready to go, and she was on her way to Raleigh to file as this announcement kind of made shockwaves through North Carolina and national political circles, which is just to push back briefly on what you just said, which is Linda Bennett knew. Now, she had some kind of conversation with Mark Meadows.
I understand just anecdotally.
Yeah.
I mean, she is very close friends with Mark Meadows' wife.
Okay.
And so that may be,
that.
You know,
yeah.
where, you know, I don't know. And, you know, these things leak. And, you know, somebody gets word
sure.
before somebody else does, always. But I know some close confidants of Mark Meadows. current Representative Kevin Corbett,
right.
who represents that part of the state, too, is, I understand, a close personal friend of Mark Meadows as well. And, you know, one time there were things kind of banted about of if Mark Meadows were to make another decision to run for something else, would here's the likely list of people who might be interested. And Kevin Corbin's name was one. Now, he has filed for the North Carolina Senate seat, and too late in the game
to switch and do that.
Right.
So two quick notes, and Rob, jump back in if you want.
Sure.
Mark Meadows is only 60 years old, so politically speaking, he's a relatively young man. Then, just full disclosure, as we sit here and have a conversation at quarter of four on a Thursday afternoon, candidate filing is not complete until the end of the day on Friday, the 20th, tomorrow, as we sit here and record this. So my expectation is that we're going to see a couple of Republicans.
A flurry.
Yeah,
oh,
a flurry.
Right.
Is a very nice way to
I would agree.
Everybody wants to be in Congress. You know, it's a thankless job. You spend half your time locked in a closed up room, asking people, begging people for money. But it still seems there's an endless supply of people who both want to be members of Congress, who want to be senators, and who can concoct a scenario where they themselves are on the ticket to run for president of the United States or vice president. I guarantee you half the members of Congress can concoct such a scenario.
None of the three people in this room aspire to be in Congress.
No, I was going to correct Rob there. Not everyone wants to be in Congress. But it's certainly attractive. And when you have a strong Republican district or a district that favors one party or the other, I think we're going to see a flurry of Republican candidates who had not considered it while Mark Meadows held that seat, but now that he's announced he's going to give it up, there clearly will be interest. So see, all of a sudden, that race that we didn't anticipate of being really one of the really interesting ones, all of a sudden is one of the most interesting ones.
Okay. 2019 struck me, as I thought about it in the last few days, in many ways as the year of inaction. No more supermajorities. The governor got teeth to his veto, and he sustained all 14 of the bills that he blocked. Republicans, having been in power for 8 years, didn't really have anything of major import that they wanted to get done. No new state budget or divisive social policies or Medicaid expansion. There was, of course, legislative and congressional redistricting, the effects of which will be felt next November. How will you remember 2019?
You mentioned that there was a lot of nothing got done. There was a lot of inactivity. I would argue there was a whole lot of activity. Not a lot got done. A lot of bills filed.
Okay.
A lot of bills debated and gone through the General Assembly. A lot of vetoes. Governor Veto, which is not really a slip there. Governor Cooper has vetoed more bills now than all the other governors combined. So a contentious session, certainly. One thing though that they did get through that I think gets lost in a lot of this is we did have some really significant reforms to the ABC system and moving forward, particularly for craft distillers and removing regulations to kind of open up that industry. Some additional things that built on previous reforms for the craft beer industry. So, you know, that was one thing that as a free market advocate and somebody who likes to see fewer regulations to open opportunities for businesses, I was pleased with that. The redistricting and the budget veto seemed to just suck the air out of everything else this session.
Governor Cooper signed the vast majority of bills that were sent to him, of course. He did veto a lot of bills. The expectation at the beginning of the session was that if we had a governor whose vetoes could be sustained, that would force the two sides to negotiate over the budget, over a whole litany of issues. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. There wasn't much negotiation taking place. But I think it's important also to note that there were a slew of important issues that the General Assembly just basically ignored. They were in session for 11 months, but there were an array of crises: the healthcare crisis, the climate crisis, the gun violence crisis, the crisis in our correction system, the gerrymandering crisis, the fact that we still have rigged elections even after redistricting. All of those were things that the General Assembly basically didn't take up at all. There was a Second Chance Act bill that had bipartisan support, passed the Senate unanimously, supported by both right and left to give people a second chance after they've been incarcerated. Still sitting in the House. Nobody knows why. So I would say after 11 months in session, seldom have so few people toiled for so long and brought forth so little.
the health care issue, and that was kind of an issue that was part of the negotiations and going back
when
and forth.
When you say health care, just to hammer down, are we talking about Medicaid, or are we talking about rural hospitals, or all of it?
All of it.
Okay.
All of the above. And, you know, particularly looking at ways to increase access, particularly in our rural areas, and to bring down the cost of health care, and also, as always, ensuring the quality of care that we have in North Carolina. That was as the governor insisted on Medicaid expansion as part of the budget deal, Senate had said, how about if we do a special session or just focus on have a particular area where we just focus on health care. So they had pushed a lot of those things aside in hopes that we would have a session that would just focus comprehensively on health care reform. And the longer the governor sort of held forth with his stance on the Medicaid expansion, that got pushed further and further off the table. And so, you know, I was disappointed. You know, I agree with Rob. I was disappointed that we didn't see more reforms and attention on health care, because that's certainly something as health care costs continue to escalate, so that we're going to have to pay attention to at some point and sooner
and
rather
justice.
Than later.
I know that was a commonality between you two for at least part of 2019 on some bills. You and also actually, were advocating for some
criminal law reform is another big one. And there were some things done this session on that. It was a bill that passed that put some more teeth into some of the restrictions on municipalities to pass ordinances that carry criminal code. So moving forward with that, not the big reforms, but moving towards that, at least in criminal law reform, was something that I was very optimistic about and happy that they had addressed during this session.
I just think it's important to say that I don't think Cooper saw the offer of a special session on health care as really a genuine offer. They're here for 11 months. They didn't need to have a special session. They were here. They could have sat down and negotiated any time if they really wanted to negotiate about Medicaid expansion. We had Republicans in the House pushing for Medicaid expansion. The Senate wouldn't take it up. The governor was really, I think, more or less aligned with the House Republicans in that respect, and would have been, I'm certain, willing to sign some version of the bill that was advanced in the House at some point, even though I don't think he would have liked it. I think he would have probably. They could have found some common ground, but the Senate refuses to discuss the issue of Medicaid expansion in any realistic way.
And I think, you know, there's a whole lot more to health care reform than Medicaid expansion.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think the disconnect became. The governor was only interested in talking about Medicaid expansion.
Oh, I think he
the
did.
General Assembly was
stuff.
Very interested in talking about, again, how to reduce the cost of health care, increase access in rural areas, and ensure quality of care, which the governor did not seem to be interested in talking about anything except Medicaid expansion.
Well, of course, he's interested in that stuff and very interested in those issues. And as so many people have testified, Medicaid expansion is the key to that. It's the key to providing rural health care. It's
no,
the
it's
key
not.
To addressing
it's
the,
key the to,
opioid.
It's the key to getting government to pay for it.
It's what's happened in other states. It's a way of getting vast amounts of money into our state, and it literally would have saved thousands of lives. And I think it was the moral position that Cooper was staking out, and it was the absolutely correct one.
Medicaid expansion and health care reform are not the same thing.
But there's overlay. They're not
some
they're not,
overlay. I mean, what you want, but what you want with a Medicaid system is you want it to ensure quality of care. You want health care costs to be reasonable because the taxpayers are paying for those health care costs. When health care costs are lower, everybody pays lower with that. And then, of course, the access to care, particularly in rural North Carolina.
Well, that's where the rural hospitals are closing because they don't have enough money. And we know for a fact that Medicaid expansion, there's study after study shows that it would have filled a lot of that gap. And that's a reason. And people are having to travel 100 miles to get to a decent health care facility. One of the main reasons is because we didn't follow the lead of 37 other states and expand Medicaid.
I'm going to add a little bit of context, hopefully interesting, to several points you just made. Let me work backward. First, as it pertains to the conversation about Medicaid expansion, one thing that I have my eye on for 2020 is who among the House Republicans will carry the torch, so to speak, as this conversation likely continues. And the reason I mention it is because, as I think about some of the people who have been advocates for looking into some form of Medicaid expansion on the Republican side of the North Carolina House, you have Greg Murphy, no longer here, he's a congressman. You have Josh Dobson from the western part of the state, now running for statewide office. He will not be back here in 2021. And you also have Donnie Lambeth, who's a former hospital executive from Forsyth County. And from the conversations I've had, it seems as though he has a challenge. He's going to – his district is a little less of a shoo-in, and he has a challenge come 2020. So if none of those three are here come 2021, I tend to wonder, okay, if this conversation is going to continue, who's going to effectively carry that Medicaid torch.
Well, it might be the Democrats because they might have control of the House at that point, and they might have control of the Senate. So I'm sure that's what they're hoping
that,
for.
That, of course, would be absolutely a game changer. Real quick, some math. You mentioned all the bills that were filed, and this is just top of mind because I looked at it this week. Almost 1,700 bills were filed at the legislature in 2019. 217 of them made it up the street to the governor. That's about 15%. Which, and I don't have historical context to add whether that's good or bad. It's about three times as good as Congress. I can tell you that.
Right, right. Yeah.
But it's
well, just
point,
anecdotally.
Small, right,
I mean, you know, and again, I don't have those numbers in front of me either. But that is about what we normally see.
Right.
There are a lot more bills filed
oh, yeah,
than actually
oh,
get
anybody
through.
Can file
and, you
a bill.
Know, all
there's
of
no
those.
Limit on how many bills lawmaker X or lawmaker Y can file. Some states there are limits of like
right,
10 bills.
Well, we tried that here actually for a while, and
didn't work.
Nah, it doesn't
too,
work.
Too many ideas.
Right. Yeah. Well, and Cooper. So in effect, he signed 94% of the bills they sent him.
And let me also just say this with a tip of the cap to my brother-in-law, who was once the general counsel to two-term New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson. He was known as Governor Vito. Take a guess at how many – I'm going to cover up the note on my paper in case you saw it. How many bills do you think – then I believe he ran for president, of course, as a Libertarian.
Right.
But he was a Republican two-term governor of New Mexico, and he literally was known as Governor Vito.
Probably proudly.
So that's why I wanted to double back to this because it's good. Like, I mean, just for context, Cooper vetoed 14 this year.
42 total, I think.
So right, Cooper has vetoed 42 in 3 years.
That, yeah, I think
and
that
this
number's
year,
right.
So he
yeah,
did,
14 this
yep,
year,
yep,
but
it was very
42
So he did 28 in his first 2 years, Cooper.
Yeah,
and then this year
I've
he did 14,
right.
So it was actually mm-hmm. very proportional to the first
yeah,
2 years.
Consistent.
Mm-hmm. So Cooper has now done 42 in 3 years. Gary Johnson did 739 in two terms as governor of New Mexico. That's just – it's worthless trivia that was worth dropping
yeah,
in.
That is amazing.
And then there was the decade, a hyper-recap here. Republicans took back both chambers of the legislature for the first time in a century. House Bill 2 was among some very contentious policy measures. North Carolina emerged as a swing state with lots of presidential visits, court battles, court battles, court battles. How will history look back at this transformative decade?
Well, I think nationally, North Carolina has really struggled. I think HB 2, I think the recent nonsense surrounding the University of North Carolina system have caused this continual reputational result nationally that we are seen sort of in a comic mode or a state that's really struggling to keep up with modern times. But as a practical matter, when it comes to what's been going on in state government and state politics, it's clear that we've had some transformation in the parties, particularly, I would say, the Republican Party. The party that nominated John McCain for president is just in a few years would, I think, be unrecognizable. McCain's turning it over in his grave that same party that nominated him is now completely under the thumb of Donald Trump. That is a remarkable transformation. We've also seen transformation in the Democratic Party with the demise of a lot of conservative rural Democrats leaving the party and becoming Trumpists in many instances. So the rural-urban divide in our politics continues to become more and more noteworthy, and I think it's playing out in how the two parties are behaving.
I think this decade will be seen as transformational reforms in a good way, in a fiscal, economic, the economic engine that North Carolina has become. You know, in fiscal issues, we are a national model. We have had transformational tax reform. We have considerably lowered and simplified our tax system. We've reined in the growth of government. The growth of government since 2011 has been within the growth of population plus inflation every single budget that's been passed since 2011. The governor has vetoed every one of those budgets, which I think is telling, or every one of those governor's budgets since he's been the governor, not since 2011. Governor Cooper has vetoed every budget he has been presented. But in addition to tax reform, reining in the growth of government, we've also seen a real change in regulations and changing the way that we look at regulations, doing a cost-benefit analysis, also doing a periodic review of regulations, looking at what was the original intent. Do we still need it? Does it need to be stronger? Do we need to get rid of it entirely? And with that process, we've seen about 15% of the rules in North Carolina completely removed from the books. which frees up people to do things, to start businesses, to be entrepreneurs, to do those kind of things. And then in addition to that, we've made smarter investments, more long-term calculated investments in infrastructure, which I think has clearly changed the way that we have built North Carolina. And then finally, I think we've changed the focus of where we're investing in education and putting that money, focusing on outcomes rather than inputs in education, and looking at where's the biggest bang for the buck, where can we open up the most opportunities for students in the classroom. So it's a real different way of looking at things. In my view, it's these reforms have been transformational and have really pushed North Carolina's economy to the forefront. And in many cases, we are a model for other states of how to do things, how to structure taxes, how to find efficiencies and effectiveness to make government work well. All those kind of things have happened in the last 10 years.
And, of course, I would say the exact opposite. I would say that our core structures and services have been eviscerated over the last decade. We're still spending less on education per pupil than we did a decade ago. We have eviscerated our environmental protection laws. We have transformed our tax code into one that has deposited billions of dollars on the wealthy and profitable corporations at the expense of people at the bottom and the middle. Our economy is increasingly divided between haves and have-nots. We have dozens of counties in our state that have fewer jobs than they had a decade ago. They've been left behind. The modern economy is increasingly divided. And I would say, actually, that our government has really just neglected and abdicated its responsibility to address those problems.
A brief question, and I swear I'm listening to both of you, so maybe this is going to feel a little bit repetitive. But briefly, Rob, for you, is North Carolina better off than it was 10 years ago?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I think okay. We have the crises I listed at the top of the show are multiplying.
Becky, is your part? I'm not. I know you think that it is. I mean,
that is correct.
I know
yes,
you do.
That is a correct assumption.
I'm giving you a different
yes.
question that
right.
I don't yeah. know the answer to, okay. and I am intrigued to hear your answer, which is your party, the Republican Party?
Now, that's not my party. I mean,
You're a Republican.
Becky Gray is a registered Republican.
Right.
The organization that I work for is a nonpartisan.
I was not trying to unfairly loop in.
And
the
you can
Foundation.
Check that on the voter record. I mean, this isn't a secret.
Right. No. I, as a Republican, for you as a conservative, is the Republican Party better or worse, in a better or worse place from your perspective, your opinion, than it was a decade ago?
I am concerned about some of the things that Donald Trump has done. I'm concerned about the country, but I'm concerned about the leadership that we're seeing across the board. As we look at the candidates who are going to oppose Donald Trump in this election, I'm not seeing anybody that I'm particularly excited about or that I think that vision that they have for our country is the one that we need to go to. So I think everything is relative and everything is dependent on other things. As far as North Carolina, I think we clearly are better than we were. We have some of the lowest unemployment in decades. More people are working. More people have jobs. More people are able to provide for themselves without looking to government to do that. They can provide for themselves. They can provide for their families. North Carolina's economy is strong and is growing stronger, and that's exactly what we, in my view, that's what we want.
Plenty more to talk about in 2020. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and an optimistic new year.
Yeah. Happy holidays, guys.
Happy holidays.
We do appreciate you tuning in to these podcasts, which drop twice a week right now. There's the weekly review with Becky and Rob. Look for that on Friday afternoons. And you can, of course, listen to it on the radio, 450, on All Things Considered on WUNC. Then we have our longer form conversations earlier in the week. If you missed the conversation with Henry Fry, former state lawmaker and justice, as well as Chief Justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, make sure you check that out. Very, very interesting guy. That'll do it for 2019. Thanks for subscribing to the program. Remember, you can leave us a review and rating as well wherever it is that you do your on-demand listening. For Becky and Rob, my name is Jeff. Hope you enjoy the holidays, and we'll talk to you again in 2020.